Well, in 1917, a man named Cameron Townsend moved to a country called Guatemala. So this was almost 100 years ago. And some of you have been down there. If you think it's somewhat of a primitive place now, it was a very primitive place then. It was just little villages and jungles. That was pretty much it. But he wanted an adventure. He was only 21 years old at the time. And he was from Los Angeles, and he wanted an adventure, and so he traveled down there, and he was a salesman. He sold books, and he would go around trying to sell books to people. He went to this town back then, still today, called Antigua. It took him days to get there from Guatemala City. Now it takes about an hour. He started selling books in the area. Now, he was a Christian. One of the books he sold was the Bible. He was trying to sell the Bible and other religious books and other kinds of books to people just to try to help make their lives better. But he realized that there were some significant problems when he got down there. I don't know if he didn't figure this out on the way or what, but when he got down there, he realized that poverty was huge in this area where he was. It was just poverty everywhere he looked. He also realized, and if you don't have any money, like, you're not going to buy books. So that's a problem if you're a book salesman, you know? And then he realized that education is horrible and there's no health care. And so if people can't even go to school, if they can't get adequate health care, are they really going to care about reading books? And then the biggest thing he realized was people couldn't even read. Like, illiteracy was off the charts. Nobody could read. Most of the people didn't even speak Spanish. They spoke these Mayan languages. They were indigenous people, and they could just speak your language, and that was it. They couldn't read or anything like that. And so as Cameron Townsend began to live there, and as he began to try to sell books, and he began to get to know the people there and start to see the people the way that God actually saw the people, God birthed a vision in his life. God touched him and said, I want you to do something way bigger than selling books. Like, selling books is good, and I know that's what brought you down here, and I actually used that to get you down here, but I want you to do something way bigger than that. I want you to start addressing the issue of poverty in this entire country. I want you to start addressing issues of healthcare and education in this entire country, and I want you to do something about the illiteracy here. Now, he couldn't believe it. He was this 21-year-old kid from L.A., and all he could kind of say to God was, okay, I have no idea how this is going to happen. I have no idea how I can do, like, I don't have a background in any of that. I'm just a salesman. That's all I am. Like, I don't know, I have no idea how anything could happen. Hey, you could use me to do anything about any of these problems and any of these people's lives that I see all around me, but as he saw people the way God saw them, and as he wrestled with that tension of what is and then what could be and should be, it's like God birthed a vision in his heart and his life, and it would change his entire life. Because that's what vision does. And that's what we said last week when we started the series. We said, we're going to talk about this idea of vision, and vision is simply coming before God and saying, God, would you open my heart and would you open my eyes to the world around me? And then in the midst of that, as I wrestle with the tension of what is, what my school looks like, what my workplace is, what my family is, what my city is, what my friends' lives is, as I wrestle with that tension, and then I see what could be and should be, and what you maybe want to do in their hearts, in their lives, in our family, in our neighborhood, in our school, in our country, in our city, whatever it is, as I wrestle with that, God births vision in our lives. And he gives meaning. He gives us a goal. He gives us something to be a part of, something that he wants to do through us and in us in the next 6 months of our life, in the next year, in the next 5 years, so we can be a part of something huge. And vision, it gives us purpose. When you have vision in your life, you have purpose. You have motivation. You have passion. Even the mundane things take on a new meaning because you realize I'm doing something. I'm a part of something so much bigger than myself. That's what this series is about. And we started reading the story of this guy named Nehemiah, who lived a long time ago. He lived in Persia in the 5th century. And we won't go through all the history again. You can go back and listen to last week's message if you weren't here. But basically, at that time, the city of Jerusalem lay in rubble and ruins. And there were just a handful of people living there. And Nehemiah got this vision from God. He heard this news. His brother and some people came back from Jerusalem. And Jerusalem had been destroyed 100 years before by the Babylonians. And the Jewish people were sort of no more. The nation of Israel is no more. There was just some Jews living in Persia. And he heard this news. He asked them, how's Jerusalem? How are things going? And his brother and the people said, it's a disgrace. Like, it's nothing. Like, they haven't rebuilt anything there. The walls are still in ruins. The gates are still in ruins. It's not even really a city. And it broke Nehemiah's heart. This guy, he had never even been to Jerusalem, but it broke his heart. Because he knew what God was up to in history, and he knew God was doing something in Jerusalem. God was going to bring people back there, and that God was going to do something significant in Jerusalem and through the people of Israel to bring his grace and his love to everybody in the whole world. And so Nehemiah knew God was up to that, and yet when he heard this news, when he saw the problems, when he saw the disgrace, it's like God birthed a vision in Nehemiah's heart in that moment. Now, I asked you last week, I said, let's all go home and pray. Let's just pray. God, would you open our hearts? Would you help us to see the world around us? Would you help us see people around us? We don't even have to pray for vision. If we just see people in the world around us the way God sees it, God will birth the vision. And maybe that happened to you. It was just 1 week, you know. Maybe you forgot to pray. Maybe it didn't happen. Maybe there's been something that you feel like God has been telling you for the last few weeks or months or years of your life, and this is just starting to clarify and confirm that. Or maybe you kind of prayed and it was just like, yeah, not getting any answers, God. Like, I don't really see the world any different. Like, let me just encourage you, wait and keep praying. Because that's what this whole series is about. And it's going to take time. And it takes God bringing to our awareness what's going on around us. And I just believe with all my heart, if we will commit ourselves to saying, wherever you are in your spiritual journey, maybe you're not even sure if you believe in God yet, but you kind of believe in him, but there's Jesus and the Bible, and some of that doesn't make total sense to you. But still, just pray, God, if you really do exist, and if you're doing something big in this world, bigger than me in my life, I want to be a part of that. So help me see what you're doing around me. And then I trust and I believe God will birth vision in your life. Now, you know the vision that God birthed in Nehemiah's life and in his heart? Here's what he actually sort of told Nehemiah. When I say told, I don't mean like audibly, but in his heart, here's what Nehemiah, as he wrestled and he prayed, here's the idea that came to his mind and his heart. I think I need to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls. Like that's the vision I think God is giving me. I need to go back to Jerusalem, a place I've never even been in my life, and rebuild the walls around this city. So Nehemiah had this idea. It was crazy at the time. It was in his heart. It was in his mind. He didn't even know what to do with it. And you remember he ends this prayer that he prayed, we read last week. We'll just read the end of it again. In Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 11, this is what how he ends his prayer. He says this, give your servant, he's praying to God, so he's talking about himself. Give, basically me, give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. And then he says, I was cupbearer to the king. Now, this is huge because we find out this detail about Nehemiah's life, that he wasn't just any Jew living in Persia. He was living in Susa, the capital city of Persia. And he wasn't just living in the capital city. He was working in the royal palace. And he wasn't just working in the royal palace. He was working directly for the king himself. And it wasn't just any king. It was King Artaxerxes I, the most powerful man in the world at the time. And it wasn't just any job. He was the cupbearer to the king. Now, the cupbearer is an interesting job. This is the guy who actually tasted the food and tasted the wine before the king did. And there was a very practical aspect to this, because if anyone was trying to poison the king, they would give the food and the wine to Nehemiah first. He would eat it. They'd wait a few minutes, see if Nehemiah was okay. If Nehemiah keels over, it's like, okay, yeah, don't eat that. But if Nehemiah's okay, then it's okay. You can eat that food. And this sounds strange to our ears, but this was a legitimate job and position and role back then because kings and their enemies were ruthless. I mean, there were plots and there were assassinations and there were poisonings all the time. Artaxerxes, the king he worked for, killed his older brother to take the throne. That's how ruthless the king was that Nehemiah worked for. So this is a real job. He would actually taste the food and taste the wine that was brought to the king. But it wasn't a throwaway job either. It wasn't something you just gave to somebody because they were dispensable, even though it may sound that way. You had to trust the person that had this job. Because more than anyone else, they would probably hear of any plots or know of anything happening inside the palace. And so the cupbearer actually became one of the most trusted men to the king. And that was Nehemiah. In fact, I want to show you a quick picture here. This is an image of a relief from ancient Persia. It's in a museum in Iran today, which is what Persia is. And this comes from one of the kings that came right before Artaxerxes, from Darius's time. So King Darius was another Persian king, and this is a relief from that time period. And you kind of see up there, it might be hard to see, but Darius, the king, is right there in the middle. And to the right is a dignitary visiting Darius the king with the soldiers behind them. So this is what would happen, a dignitary would visit. And then who's standing right behind the king? The cupbearer. The guy working with King Darius to be there holding the cup in his hand, to be one of the most trusted men to the king. So this was Nehemiah. And get this, he gets this vision from God that he needs to go back and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And here's what I think Nehemiah must have been thinking. When he has this vision, he's praying, he's heard this news, and he thinks, I need to go back. God's telling me to go back and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He's got his immediate thought. It doesn't say this in the text, but I got to imagine it. His immediate thought was, this is a great vision, God. Man, somebody should go do that. Like that, somebody, but it can't be me. Because you know me, like I've got a really important job right now. Like I cannot leave this job. Can you imagine what my boss would say if I go and tell my boss, just in case you know God, he's the king. If I went and told my boss that I have to leave for a long period of time to go do this thing, my boss is never going to go for that. I can't go talk to him about that. Not to mention, the very boss that I would have to ask permission to go do this from would be the most threatened person by someone going back and rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Because Artaxerxes was in charge of the whole empire and making sure he maintained peace and, more importantly, control over the whole empire. And he was always putting down rebellions. We have historical records from the Bible and outside the Bible. All over his reign, he's putting down rebellions in Egypt. He's putting down rebellions in Turkey, what's modern-day Turkey. He's putting down rebellions all over. And he even was concerned about putting down rebellions in Jerusalem. In fact, get this. 13 years before this, King Artaxerxes, the same king, had gotten a letter from some of the people living in the province of Trans-Euphrates. That's where Jerusalem, the ruined city, was in. And some of the people and some of the other leaders in other cities wrote to King Artaxerxes and said, hey, the people are rebuilding Jerusalem and they're even starting to rebuild the walls and we don't like it. We think that they're preparing for a rebellion against you. You need to do something about it. And so King Artaxerxes wrote a letter back to them, and we even have the letter. It's in the book of Ezra. And look at this. I want to read it for you just real quickly. This is what it says. The king sent this reply to Rehum, the commanding officer, Shimshai, the secretary, and the rest of their associates living in Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. Greetings. The letter you sent has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order and a search was made, and it was found that this city, he's talking about Jerusalem, has a long history of revolt against kings and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates. So he's remembering Israelite history where David and Solomon and all these kings used to rule over the whole area. And taxes and tribute and duty were paid to them. He goes on and says, now, issue an order to these men to stop work so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter. Why let this threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests? So the last time that King Artaxerxes cared at all about Jerusalem was when this threat was raised several years before, and he issues an edict to say, hey, tell them to stop rebuilding, because I don't want it to go into a threat. I don't want them to rebel against me. I want to put this down right where it's at. So that's the history. And Nehemiah's got to be thinking in this moment, yeah, rebuilding the walls, great idea, God, but I am not the person to go do that. Because I work for the king, and last time somebody talked to him about Jerusalem, it did not go well. He had to be having those thoughts. And yet, Nehemiah came to a very different conclusion. A conclusion that I think each and every one of us need to come to when we have visions that God gives us. Because God will give us the what in our life. He'll give us the vision. And everything in us will think of all the reasons that I shouldn't be the person to go live out this vision. Nehemiah came to the conclusion that not only does God give us the what, but God also calls the who. And you are the who. That if God gives you a vision for something, you're the one to go do it. If God gives you a vision for your life, if he burdens you with something going on around you, if he helps you see the way something is and the way it could be and should be, you are the who. You're the who that should go do something about what he's showing you. You see, Nehemiah's position and his job and his background and the history and everything that was going on could have been all the reasons that Nehemiah gave to God as to why he shouldn't be the person to go do this thing. And yet Nehemiah actually came to the conclusion that maybe I'm the perfect person of goodness. Maybe God has prepared me. Maybe God put me in this position. Maybe God has given me the gifts. Maybe God has given me the background. Maybe God has given me the education. Maybe God has uniquely brought me to this very place in my life and given me this vision because he wants me to be the person to go and live it out. See, Nehemiah believed God had used his circumstances to prepare him for that vision. And I think he does that with you and me as well. You see, maybe you're getting glimpses of some vision in your life, like something you feel like God is calling you to do, but everything in you is going, but my boss is never going to go for that. If I go talk to him about it, I'm not the right person. I'm not even good at that. I'm not gifted at that. I've not been prepared for that. There's people that would be way better at that. I'm just me. Man, I'm introverted. I'm not assertive. I'm not aggressive. I'm not good at accomplishing things. I don't know how to organize things. It's almost as if God is saying, no. You got to understand. Everything in your life, I've given you to prepare you for this. I gave the vision to you because I actually think you're the best person to go live this out. I've given you the gifts and the personality and the circumstance, even the broken, messed up, horrible circumstances of your past. I can even use those now as part of the vision that I've given you in your life now. See, God gives us the what, and he also calls us to be the who whenever he gives vision in our lives. But now, here's something else. We're going to read on and see what else Nehemiah does when God bursts his vision and he realizes he's the person to go live it out. God not only gave him the what, he not only realized, you know, you are the who, but he waited for the when. He waited for the right moment for when he should go do something. Let's read on and look at what happens after Nehemiah prays for success. This is what it says. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and I gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. He says, I was very much afraid. Now, I don't know if I'm sure you don't remember it from last week, but when Nehemiah first heard the news, he says it was the month of Kislev. Kislev in our system was about late November, early December. So Thanksgiving, they're eating, you know, getting ready for Christmas. And he gets this news. Now, again, I'm sure you don't know your Hebrew months right off, so I'll show them to you. Kislev, November, December. And then after that comes Tevet. And then Shavat. And then Adar. And then Nisan. So Nehemiah hears the news. And he mourns. And he prays. And he fasts. And it's like God gives him this vision, but he waits. Not for a few days. Not even for a few weeks, but for a few months. And this happens at, you know, whatever, Thanksgiving. And it's Easter when he's finally realizing that something's going to start happening with this vision. It's like Nehemiah realizes, I have to wait for God. Even though God is doing something in my heart, even though he's showing me something, even though he's burdening me with something, I have got to wait for God. And until God shows me what the next step is, I'm just going to pray, and I'm going to fast, and I'm going to mourn, and I'm going to think. I'll even plan ahead. It's like he's thinking, like, what if this is the vision from God? What would it take? What would I need? How long would I be gone? What? It's like he's thinking all of these things, and yet he realizes, but I've got to wait for God. And so here he is, 4 or 5 months later. And finally, he's at another banquet, or there's some other dignitary, and he's there, and the king's there, and everyone's there, and he brings, you know, if we put the verses back up there, he brings the wine to the king, and the king looks at him, and something's different about Nehemiah today. It's like up until now, he's been able to hide it. He hasn't shown it. It's just been his personal wrestling, but now, finally, the king looks at him and goes, something different. Which, when you're the cupbearer in charge of making sure assassinations and plots don't happen, that's not a good position to be in. When the king looks at you and he goes, you're not acting normal today. Something is different about you today. Why are you so sad? To which Nehemiah must have been scared to death. That's why he says, I was very much afraid. Like, it's this defining moment in his life. Look at how he responds. Next verse. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Just in case you were wondering, I'm all about the king living forever. May the king live forever. Let me get that out of the way first. Why should my face not look so sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? And the king said to me, what is it you want? Now let's stop there for a second and don't miss this, because this is huge. Nehemiah tells him what's going on. Now notice he doesn't even use the word Jerusalem. Now the king would have known, because he knew Nehemiah was a Jew and he knew his ancestors were from there. So he knew, but it's almost as if Nehemiah is a little scared to even use that word, because that might bring up sort of bad connotations. But he's honest. He says, this is what's going on. You know, the city where my people long ago are from, it's still in ruins. That's why I'm so sad. Something inside of me is broken because of me. And the king looks at me and says, okay, what is it that you want? And it's almost like in this very moment, God is saying to Nehemiah, I will give you the vision. Like, I will give you the what? And you are the who. It's you. I've picked you to do this. And you've waited for the when. Like, you have waited and waited and waited and prayed and thought and mourned and fasted. Like, you've done all this. And if you'll do all of that, I'm going to let you know you can trust me with the how. I will take care of how this vision is going to get lived out. Because in that moment, think about it. God took a Persian king who didn't even believe in God, who cared only about his own empire, who was bent on maintaining control over his own empire and would never let any kind of military threat rise up within his own empire. And this Persian king looked back at Nehemiah in light of the history of what had happened in Jerusalem. And he hears that this guy, his most trusted man, comes to him and says, I think I want to go back and do something here. And he responds by saying, what do you want, Nehemiah? It's like God was saying, you can trust me with the how. And look at what Nehemiah does in the next verse. Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. Now, I love this. He doesn't even tell us what he prayed. He doesn't tell us how long he prayed. It probably wasn't out loud. It was probably really, really short. It was just one of those in the moment, like, oh my goodness. Okay, God, here we go. Like, here we go. You better come through, because I am like my life is on the line right now. And he answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. And then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, so both of the decision makers are there. Like, everybody's there. This isn't just this personal conversation. Nehemiah's letting us know. Everyone heard this. He asked me, how long will your journey take? And when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me. And so I set a time. He goes on. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park or the royal forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy? You see, the king of Persia had this huge forest, and there was somebody in charge of it. And most people think the forest was in Lebanon, where there was huge cedars that would grow. And so basically what he's asking is, on my way down there, can I stop by the royal forest and cut down as many trees as I want so I can rebuild the citadel and the walls and my own house? And because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my requests. And so I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and I gave them the king's letters. And the king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. And see, Nehemiah, it's like he was ready for this moment. He was scared to death. He had been praying and waiting for 4 months. And yet, he had fought through everything. He had planned, if this moment ever comes, how long will I be gone? What will I need? Will I need safety? Will I need security? What kind of resources? What kind of materials will I need? It's like he was ready for this moment, but he waited until God brought him there. He was prepared as he possibly could, and yet he even knew that if I get to that moment, there's still a huge gap between what I want and reality. There's still this huge gap between this vision that I feel like God has given me and how it's ever going to get accomplished. And that's when God stepped in and took care of the how it would get accomplished. Now, this is so important because more visions die over the question of how than anything else. See, God will give you a what, and you'll look over immediately at how, and you have no idea how it could ever happen, and the vision dies. God gives you a picture of how, of what your family could look like, of what your neighborhood could look like, of some need, of a group of people that have this huge need of something that you could do in their life. God gives you a vision, and then you immediately go to how in the world is that ever going to happen? How in the world could you ever use me? I don't have what it takes. Like, I just have no idea. I mean, it's a great vision, God, but I have no idea how I could ever do anything about that. And if there's anything clear from Nehemiah's story, and if there's anything clear from the Bible, and if there's anything clear from other people's stories that have told me all my life, it's that God will always give the what, but then we have to trust him with the how. And he rarely gives the what and also gives the how in the same sentence. Like, it almost never happens. And yet God is like an expert at how. He loves how. He takes care of how. He's amazingly creative with the how. In fact, if God gives you a what and you think you already know the how, it's probably not a vision from God. Like, if God has given you a what, and you think you already have it figured out how you're going to accomplish it, how you'll get it done, there's a good chance it's not even a vision from God. It might be a good vision, but it's probably not a God-given vision, because God rarely gives the how when he gives the what. And when he gives the what, there's always this sense of, I have no idea how. Now, how do you tell, like, a good vision from a God-given vision? Let me give you a couple of tips. A good vision is always going to be limited to your resources and your potential. A God-given vision will be limited to God's resources and God's potential. For a good vision, the outcome is going to be up to you. I mean, you'll have to pull it off and do it. And you can pull off, and I can pull, we can pull off some stuff. For a God-given vision, the outcome is always up to God. We do everything we can, but we trust the outcome is up to God. A good vision, at the end of the day, it's going to fuel your pride. You'll be like, yeah, look at that. Look at what I pulled off. Look at what I did. God-given vision. There's this sense at the end of the day that there is no question in the world that God did it. Like, I just contributed my little mustard seed of faith, and I used what he gave me, and then he stepped in huge. In ways I never could have imagined. I mean, the how that he brought to it was totally different than I could have ever imagined. And maybe right now there's a vision in your heart and you feel like there's something building and you feel like God is saying, here's the what. Here's something significant I want to do in your life in the next few months, in the next year, in the next few years. And if right now you feel like you've got it all figured out and you've kind of got this sense of, yeah, I know exactly how it could work and I can pull it off and I can do that, then it might just be a good vision. But if there's a sense right now in your heart of, I have no idea how that could ever happen, and I don't have the potential to pull that off, I don't have the gifts to pull that off, I don't have the resources to do that, I have no idea, well, then it might be a God-given vision. He's birthing in your heart right now. Because the vision God gave to Nehemiah, on the surface, it was impossible. To go back to Jerusalem, nobody knew Nehemiah there. He had no influence there. He was maybe the cupbearer in Persia, but he had no influence in Jerusalem. He hadn't even been living there. The people probably wouldn't trust him. He wasn't one of them. He wasn't a native. He didn't have that bumper sticker on his car, you know? He didn't know how to rebuild a city. He didn't know how to rebuild walls. Last time people tried to rebuild them, the project fell apart. It got stamped out by the king. I mean, everything said that this was impossible. And Nehemiah only had everything to lose by going back and doing this. When he thought about the how, he must have thought, this is impossible. And yet in that moment, when he finally just kind of says, okay, here we go. King, I'm thinking about going back to Jerusalem. The king says, oh, yeah, how long you be gone? That's great. Oh, you want some wood? Sure, go take as much as you want. Oh, you want letters to all the governors of Trans-Euphrates to make sure you stay, you know, safe and secure and they don't mess with you? I'll make sure nobody messes with you. Here's a letter. Oh, you know what, let me send an armed escort. Let me send some soldiers and cavalry down just to protect you on your way down. And it's like in that moment, God showed up huge and said, I will take care of the how if you'll just trust me. Now, we're going to come back next week and pick up the story there and see that God was just beginning to get started. But here's the big point today. He gave Nehemiah the what. Nehemiah was convinced that he was the who. And then he waited for the when, and then he trusted God with the how. Cameron Townsend, 21-year-old guy down in Guatemala, he also trusted God with the how. He had no idea how he could make any kind of dent in any of these things. And yet, he said, okay, I'll do what I can. He started building schools, started trying to help teach kids, started trying to give people adequate health care and take care of them. tried to deal with issues of poverty, tried to help the indigenous Mayan people that were living down there. And he said, I need to do something about this illiteracy. I have no idea what to do. I don't have any background in this. I'm young. I have no training. I don't even know what to do, but I guess I'll start by learning this language they're speaking. It's a language called Kachikel. This is Mayan indigenous language. He's one of the few Westerners to ever learn it at that point. He learned this language, and then he wrote it down. Nobody had ever written this language down. He actually came up with a grammatical structure for the entire language. No one had ever done that. It was just an oral language at this point. And then he started teaching other people how to learn this language. And then he started teaching the people that spoke this language how to read and write their own language for the very first time in their history. And then he translated the Bible into this language so they could read about Jesus and learn about him. And then he realized that there are thousands of other languages around the world. There are millions of other people like this who are impoverished and who have all kinds of problems. And some of the problems start with illiteracy, and some of the problems start with they can't even read, and they can't even read the good news about Jesus in their own language. And so he had a bigger vision, and he started this linguistics institute and this organization called Wycliffe that's now the largest linguistics and translation institution in the entire world. And it all started with this guy who was just selling books. And yet he saw people the way God saw them. And God birthed a vision in his life, but he had no idea how he could ever do this, but he just trusted God with the how. I think that's what God wants to do with each one of us. And so here's what I want you to do this week. Here's the thing I want to just ask you to do. I want you to go home and pray, God, help me to see the people around you the way you see them. You might be thinking, isn't that the same thing we were supposed to do last week? Yeah, it is. And it might take 4 weeks. It might take 4 months. It might take 4 years. But I'm confident that we don't have to worry about the how. We don't have to worry about the when. We don't have to worry about all of those things if we'll just say, God, I think you could use me. I don't even know, I don't have a theology background. I haven't even read the whole Bible. I don't understand all this. I'm not even like a super religious person. But I think you can use me in a significant way. So I'm just going to pray for 5 minutes every morning. I'm just going to pray with some friends one time this week. I'm just going to pray, God, open my eyes to the people around me and help me to see them the way you see them and help me be open to whatever vision you want to give me. Let me pray. God, that is our prayer today. And I know each one of us could do things the way you use Nehemiah, the way you use Cameron Townsend, the way you've used people in your church and across this world all throughout the ages. Simple people with a simple faith and a simple trust in you who don't set out to change the world, who just set out to live out whatever vision you give them. And so, Father God, we come before you now and we recognize that you're really the king. Artaxerxes isn't the king. We don't serve human kings. We serve a living king over this whole world. And we can come before you with our prayers, our worries, our doubts, our concerns, the things on our heart. And we can trust in who you are. And you've got something huge planned for each one of our lives. I pray this in your name. Amen.